Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at KSFR.org, podcasting at SantaFeRadioCafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at Facebook.com/RadioCafe. I'm delighted now to welcome back to the program Merle Lefkoff. She's an international mediator, and she's applying the new science of complexity to diplomacy in peacemaking. She's founder and director of the nonprofit organization Ars Publica. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
So let's just talk for a moment about complexity science and diplomacy and peacemaking. Those are things that probably to the average listener you wouldn't think go together.
Well, I'll say a little bit about that. Those of us who are not complex systems scientists but are applying the theories that are being developed by the scientists who mostly find out what they're finding out by doing computer simulations, which are fascinating. We like the metaphors. They're so juicy, especially in the area of peace building and diplomacy. I mean, for example, a lot of people think we're at the edge of chaos now. And
like in real life. You
like
look
in
around
real life, right.
At climate change and the Middle East and so on, and the oceans dying and all this stuff, and it's like we're at the edge of chaos.
We're at the edge of chaos, and it's a fabulous metaphor. And what scientists tell us is that when things get to that point, that's the time when change is most possible. And that can go either way.
Fundamental mind-shifting change.
Huge shifting change. And the metaphor, edge of chaos, is one that people can identify with as a time of the possibility of profound change. And what complexity science is about not knowing the future. And so the edge of chaos is also marked by a time of profound ambiguity. We can't tell you what's going to happen next. None of us can in Egypt or in Libya because it is unknowable. The future is unknowable in complexity terms. So it's fascinating to think about how to apply this to diplomacy and peace building.
When you have a system that tells you that you can't predict anything, what can it do?
It can open up every potential and every possibility. And we know, because we can't predict, that there will be surprises along the way. A lot of people call the science of complexity the science of surprise, for example. Things that we couldn't predict that suddenly happened to shift everything. I prefer to talk about it when I do give talks on complexities, on applied complexity science, to talk about it as the science of emergence. And
what
that's
does that mean?
That's a scientific term in complexity science as well. Out of the conditions that change, the rules change, the relationships change, the conditions on the ground change, something new will emerge. It won't be the way it was before. Change is the only thing that we can predict. So I like to use that term to talk about complexity science.
One place in the world that you have spent a lot of time and put a huge amount of attention to is in the area of Israel and Palestine, which I think even the most optimistic people, when they look at that part of the world, say, there is no good solution. The one-state solution's no good. The two-state solution's no good. Eternal war's no good. Peace is impossible. What does it look like to you?
Yeah, well, I've certainly been there myself. I've been working in the Middle East, actually, for a very long, decades, in fact. I got involved in the Middle East during the Oslo peace process when I was asked to facilitate some back-channel negotiations on what was called the water track. We don't hear a lot about how important water is and the sharing of water is as a way into peacemaking, particularly in the Middle East. But living in Santa Fe, I had a real interest in the water track during the Oslo process. So
we don't talk about it enough here.
I know. So that was how I got initially involved, and it's hard not to be involved ever since because it's one of those conflicts that is determining so much of what happens in the rest of the world in this tiny little place. It is just having a huge effect on what happens in the rest of the world.
Why is that?
I'm not sure. I think it's because the situation there, the fact that Israel has been has had such a dominant position in the Middle East, and with the increasing situation in Palestine, in the West Bank, which are the occupied territories, more and more people around the world, particularly in Islam, have paid attention to that because it's their poster child for the victimization that they feel. I think that's probably the reason.
So in Israel and Palestine, or Israel and the occupied territories, you really do have a great deal of victimization, but there's narratives of victimization on both sides.
Yes, of course. There's the narrative of the Holocaust, of course. And on the Palestinian side, and I don't think a lot of people know this, they have their narrative as well, and it begins in 1948 with the founding of the State of Israel. And that was the beginning of what many Palestinians believe was the genocide of their people as well.
And they have a word for it, which
Natka
means
the catastrophe.
The catastrophe.
Yeah, Natka. And it means the catastrophe. And they look at it in much the same way. So it's these two victim narratives that, as I like to say, are rubbing against each other all the time, although there's an asymmetry there. And because the Israelis have such a dominant position in so many ways, and certainly in terms of being able to portray their narrative throughout the last 60 years, in books, in film, in museums. It's a huge telling of that narrative over and over and over again. I mean, even today, new books on the Holocaust are being published. So the Palestinians have not had the advantage of being able to match that kind of publicity, let's call it, about their narrative.
Well,
it's just beginning to happen.
Right, yeah, and we've had Mohammed Omer on the air recently and a number of times and other people talking about the Palestinian point of view. And, I mean, there's another asymmetry, which is the asymmetry of being able to live your daily life the way you want to. Palestinians have a harder time doing that than Israelis because they are under Israeli control, and the Israelis are not under anybody else's control.
Right, right. No, it's definitely an occupation, and it's difficult for people who haven't physically been there to see how extraordinary it is, frankly. I think everybody who goes comes back altered in the way they think about this conflict. I don't know if really any other thing that takes the place of actually going to this very small place and see how close geographically and physically people are to one another and how very, very different their lives are, the Israelis and the Palestinians, with just, you know, a few hundred yards apart. It's quite extraordinary, actually.
So in your life, and you've been doing this work for a really long time, you have facilitated countless hours of dialogue among people on different sides, including Israeli and Palestinian. And we've just been talking about this question of two different narratives, the Holocaust victim narrative and the 1948 catastrophe victim narrative. When you have those two narratives, what kind of dialogue is possible? Are you able to get people to see the other point of view?
Sometimes that happens. I mean, sometimes there's breakthrough. It depends on the dynamics of the relationships that formed during the dialogue or that were there to begin with. It's quite complex. And when I think about the fact that I've sort of moved on from facilitating dialogue into something else, which we'll talk about in a minute, what I like to say is I think about all that dialogue, and not just the work that I've done, but thousands of people have been in dialogue for many, many years in Israel and Palestine across both lines, that's kind of yeast for the bread. That is not going to go away. Many people have big changes in dialogue. And then I like to think about when peace finally comes, and I have to think about it that way, when peace finally comes, all that dialogue is going to pay off. It's like yeast. But the bread still hasn't risen, and it's a long way from being out of the oven.
Interesting. So, I mean, sometimes it's important to just ask a kind of stupid question, but I have to ask you, why is it so hard to have peace there? Is it a matter of leadership? Is it a matter of what's happening on the level of the ordinary people? How do you see it?
It's many things. Leadership certainly would be helpful, and this is on both sides, by the way, would be helpful if we'd had better leadership in the Middle East on both sides. And I won't go into detail on that. These narratives that come out of victimization propel these public policy and peace processes mostly backwards, frankly, and not forward.
Really?
So the populations on both sides have sort of just get pretty stuck in these narratives, these victim narratives, and it doesn't allow them to move forward into anything that makes sense in terms of new ideas and creative ideas for peace in the Middle East, because the old ones simply aren't going to happen, and everybody who follows this agrees with that. The peace camps have been very important in that they talk to each other, but they've been completely marginalized in terms of public policy and in terms of diplomacy. Completely marginalized. And we need some new ideas. We need some new ways of thinking about what the future could be if there were some creative new solutions emerging.
So recently you had a long extended conversation with people from a lot of different places in the world about just this. Tell us about what happened.
I'm very fortunate to be part of an academic studies group that originated at Columbia University, and it is called the Humiliation and Human Respect Studies Group.
And we did not have that major when I was in college.
No, we didn't either. It sounds kind of flimsy if you think about it in academic terms, but this is very deep academic research by psychiatrists, MD psychiatrists, psychologists, social scientists, neuroscientists, some guys who are experts in terrorism have come in because they're really, really interested in what causes someone to strap a bomb around their waist. It's a fascinating group. And the woman who founded it, by the way, is German, who went through a great deal of trauma in her own life. And she now travels the world talking about humiliation. And we know that the present, if we think about it, so much of what's going on, particularly in the Middle East right now, is because of the humiliation of people who believe that they have no power and they're oppressed in so many different ways that are personally humiliating. And
Is that another way of talking about victimization?
Of course it is. Yeah, it is. But the humiliation, according to these studies that are going on in this program, takes a different form in the way it is psychologically internalized. And you act it out in a different way, as opposed to if you feel victimized and you want revenge on your oppressor. People who are humiliated often take it out in other ways. For example, setting yourself on fire. And as we know, that happened very recently.
In Tunisia.
That was the beginning of the revolutionary fervor that's taken over the Arab world right now, was a man who said that he was so humiliated he couldn't take it anymore, a shopkeeper in Tunisia, and set himself on fire.
And so learning what you're learning about humiliation, where does that lead in terms of figuring out how to have positive political dialogue and political change?
Our annual conference, the Humiliation and Human Respect Studies Conference, was in Istanbul this year, about 6 months ago. And during that time, and people came from everywhere for this. It was a small conference. the field is and the discipline is not well known yet. Right. There are still giggles about it, as we just did.
Well, does it include things like bullying? Because that's the first thing I thought of, because there's all this stuff on school bullying.
Yes, it does. It does.
And makes the links between school bullying and political torture.
Yes, many, many links. There are all sorts of forms. There are all kinds of forms of humiliation that result in some terrible things happening as a result of those humiliation. That humiliation and those acts of humiliation. So a couple of us just sort of met and decided we were passionate about the Middle East and the lack of momentum in the Middle East. The peace process once again just came to a dead halt, although there's always stuff going on behind the scenes, which is another conversation. So we got together and decided to stay over after the conference and talk about whether there was any possibility of a new approach to peacemaking in the Middle East. And one of our group was a young German woman in her early 20s who was sent by the German government to Bethlehem, which is in the occupied territories, to promote conflict resolution curriculum in the Palestinian schools in Bethlehem. And I had just finished co-facilitating some very secret back-channel dialogues in Santa Fe on nuclear disarmament. And we had also people, they were very secret, we couldn't publish reports, but we had some tremendous dialogue going on about why we couldn't imagine a non-nuclear future.
And these were people who make a living on nuclear...
These were people, yes, and they also came from Korea, the Middle East, and Iran, and we were very fortunate in being able to recruit the experts all over the world in this issue. We also had some folks from Los Alamos who had to take, of course, annual leave. And so it was fascinating to me because we use a process in which we ask people to write scenarios about the future, trying to think first about no contamination by the past events or trends. This is where the complexity theory comes in. That everything changes all the time, and if you can use your imagination for a fresh perspective, you might be able to find some breakthrough. This isn't the way diplomacy works.
Right.
They had
the use of imagination.
The use of imagination. You know the famous Einstein quote, imagination is more important than knowledge.
Yeah.
Very famous quote of Einstein's. So we asked these guys to imagine a non-nuclear future. And then, how did you get there? Right? Then you go back to talking about how you would change diplomacy, how you would have these meetings on a different basis. Well, they had a hell of a time trying to imagine a non-nuclear future.
They couldn't do it.
They finally, some of them began to break through at the end, but they had a very tough time. So I was telling the story in Istanbul, and young Sophie, who was at the school in Palestine, said, "That's funny, Merle," because she said, "My kids talk about the future all the time, and that's not what they say."
Now, this is little Palestinian children.
These are Palestinian kids who are, they're young people who are, the cohort group in her school are 14, 15, 16, some 17-year-olds. So they're really adolescent, moving into adulthood. They're not little kids.
And you know, when young people are in war-torn areas like that, they tend to be more politically sophisticated than their counterparts in places like the U.S.
Sure, absolutely. Anyway, so we perked up, those of us, there were five of us who had stayed over to talk about peace and potential peace in the Middle East, including two Israeli guys and a wonderful young academic from Northern Ireland who was involved in the Northern Ireland peace process. We said, "Well, Sophie, what do they say?" And she just kind of closed her eyes and she said, "Well, they say when I grow up, I'm going to have a passport just like the EU. I'm going to be able to go to the beach in Tel Aviv. I'm going to be able to go to Amman and Cairo and maybe even Paris and London."
These are Palestinian teenagers.
Under occupation.
Who've lived, we don't even want to think about what, but a lot of hard stuff.
Right, right. And yet, they just, according to Sophie, loved to talk about the future. So we all looked at each other and said, and I especially said, after coming off these dialogues with these nuclear scientists, I said, well, let's find out if these kids can tell a different story. Because Israel and Palestine are locked into these two narratives of victimization, of mass genocide and victimization. And maybe we could do a project in which we don't do any dialogue work, because one of the things that happens in kids' dialogue work is that the kids usually that come into these programs, not always, but almost always, are privileged in some way. And we wanted to avoid that. We wanted to make sure that the Palestinian kids, particularly, who would be involved, would be from the refugee camps as well as those who were more secure and in more private schools. We wanted to avoid that. And we also know that they all have access to social media, and it is difficult, unless they have a lot of privilege, to be able to leave Palestine.
So even the poorest little kids in refugee camps have access to Facebook and...
They do. It's really... And cell phones, and it's absolutely wonderful. There are small NGOs that make this happen. Believe me, not the large humanitarian organizations, unfortunately, but small NGOs pay attention to this.
And so the idea is to get a bunch of ordinary Palestinian teenagers...
And Israeli.
And Israeli teenagers...
Yes.
...via social media to envision a future in a way that maybe their parents and leaders have not been able to do.
I promise you their parents and leaders haven't been able to do it.
Right, so as we see.
Yes, all you have to do is pick up the newspaper each day to ask them to do that. But that's just the beginning.
But that's huge.
I think it would be huge to see what stories they can come up with. And the instructions to them, we want them to run the project, but they'll have graduate students who are both Palestinian and Israeli graduate students, which we're recruiting now, to mentor and coach them. But we want them to run the project. We want them to understand that those futures have to be based on their imaginary futures of what's possible if everything else is out of the way, so they don't descend, which is what often happens in dialogue, back into the victimization. So we're hoping they can come up with some wonderful projections, almost science fiction, of what that future could look like. And then we will ask them to tell us how they got there. And that's where the policy part comes in.
Right.
And if we get some really good stories, we're going to promote the hell out of them on YouTube, in the media, so that people can see that there are young people immersed inside the country, both kids are victims of the situation. Israeli and Palestinian kids are all victims in different ways. And you don't want to try to compare victimization. It's the worst thing you could ever
do.
But they're all victims of the situation.
So are you using a method with the young people similar to what you used with the nuclear people?
No, using the exact same method, actually. We're just talking about it a little differently. And it's really based in complex system science, which is to see if there are some narratives that change the rules and the conditions and what kind of potential breakthrough solutions could emerge from changing those conditions.
So and one of the conditions that you have is massive U.S. taxpayer support of Israel and a very powerful Israel lobby and Jewish community in the United States supporting Israel, a large portion of which is not particularly sympathetic to Palestinians. Some is. We have a group in Santa Fe and in other places called Another Jewish Voice, which is looking at things in a different way. But how do you take into account in processes like this the realities of military power, money, political power, and ideology?
Good question, Mary Charlotte. Good question. Let me say something about American Jews, because I am one. And I should preface this by saying I'm a long time post-Zionist, just post-Zionist.
What does that mean?
Well, it means that I don't believe that you can have it both ways if you want a democratic state. You can't have both a religious and a and a democratic state at the same time. And Israel is as some of my Israeli friends say, well, it's a democratic state with theocratic elements, and that always makes me smile. That's like being somewhat pregnant, right? I don't believe in the Jewish state. I think it's an anachronism now. I think it's important for Israel to survive, and I think we have to figure out how to make sure the best of that democracy survives. But it has to be a new model. American Jews are what makes that possible. And the American Jewish lobby, as you mentioned, it's beginning to change slowly. Probably some listeners are familiar with a new organization called J Street in Washington. That's mission is to take on AIPAC, which is the initials for the Jewish lobby that has been so powerful and continues to be powerful. We had a vote in the United Nations in the Security Council condemning the settlements. There are 15 members of the Security Council, and the only member that voted against that resolution of condemnation was the U.S. So J Street still has a lot of work to do.
Right.
Because that was an example that of something that was so easy for the administration to do, because we've been saying for a long time we were opposed to settlement expansion. And yet when it came to the U.N., AIPAC prevailed. So the American Jewish community has a huge responsibility of getting educated to the situation. I think most American Jews simply don't understand the situation. It's kind of knee-jerk to just simply support Israel and assume that all Muslims are potential terrorists and want to push Israel into the sea. This is old. This is old stuff.
Right. And when you hear that kind of conversation, you realize you're not having a conversation. You're having a kind of repetition of stuff that other people have already said. There's nothing kind of fresh about it. There's nothing original or heartfelt or real about it.
Right.
And I think, I mean, it's a lot of the kind of political dialogue that goes on over the dinner table or in cafes or wherever is kind of that received information that's said often in a belligerent manner, and it's very difficult to break through those break through to something real in those conversations.
Absolutely, but it's beginning to happen. And another Jewish voice that began in Albuquerque is part of a small but growing movement among progressive American Jews who understand that we hold the key here. Truly we do, because we give $3 billion a year in support to Israel.
So we talk about the importance of the American Jewish community in this. Then you've got Palestinian adolescents on their cell phones. How do the two meet?
Well, they're going to have to meet on their cell phones, and they're going to have to meet on their Facebook pages, and they're going to Twitter. When we were designing the project, we talked about the fact that mostly what happens, has happened in the past, is people raise money and as I say, unfortunately, mostly kids who are privileged in some way, so it's easy for them to leave, and they go somewhere else for a short period of time. This is going to be a long-term project. It's going to take a while for these kids to begin to find a way to trust a process in which they can go deeply into their imaginations. And we're going to leave it up to them whether they want to collaborate with each other, what kinds of friendships they want to make. That's just part of allowing that space and that emergence to happen without us facilitating or controlling it in any way. So it's a very different kind of project. If they want to meet at some point, we'll figure out if that's possible and if it's possible in a fair way. But that would come late in later stages of the project. What we're concentrating on now is getting funding so that we can bring these young academics in who are in graduate school, so they can begin to get some training in how to be coaches and mentors for the kids. So that there's some formality to the project, but not very much. I mean, we practice what we preach in being as open space as possible on this and trusting the kids to come up with their stories and figure out what kinds of relationships they want to have with each other during this project.
We're talking to Merle Lefkoff. What are some examples in history where being on the edge of chaos, using imagination, resulted in a really great change for the better. Can you think of some?
Oh, yeah. I can think of the American Revolution. That's the first thing, honestly, Mary Charlotte, that comes to mind. I mean, it was just the edge of chaos back here, right, in the 18th century. And there were some guys, they were guys, who said, you know what, there might be a different way to think about all of this. And it wasn't just a revolution, as we know. Out of that revolution emerged a completely new system, which is one of the exciting things about complexity science, which is that you can intervene to try to disable things you don't like, to disable an old system and try to bring it down. Or you can say, hell with that. Let's create the conditions so that something completely new can emerge. So that's an example that comes to mind right away. And that often happens in revolutions, in revolutionary times. And why this time is so exciting for me as an applied complexity scientist.
So in the time of the American Revolution, you have an amendable constitution, a secular constitution, and this idea of the inherent rights of individual human beings. And all those things are pretty new.
They were very new. They were very new. They were percolating, of course, during the French Revolution, because our revolution was happening about the same time. And so the ideas were out there. But what we did in this country with our revolution was change those conditions on the ground and change the rules. And the relationships that emerged during the constitutional conventions created a whole new idea of democracy.
So going from the rights of kings to the rights of individual people, we take that for granted. Then it was a brand new big idea, and the idea that it was a secular government that was not inherently based on the power of the church in any way. Okay, what are the equivalent, in your view, what are the big ideas of today?
You know, you were talking about the rights of the individual. I'm not so sure that came about until quite recently. I mean, the idea behind the revolution was that the people would be in charge.
Certain inalienable rights, among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Right. But until the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which came much, much later, I don't think that was enshrined as something that became a global idea. And that idea is still new. And it is an idea that has a cultural context to it that is difficult to operationalize in cultures that believe that the way you move forward is in a collective way, not based on the individual. I'm simplifying this, but I think this is an idea that's still waiting to be adopted.
Good point.
Globally.
Because if we adopted that idea, we could, by definition, never fight a nuclear war, and indeed never fight a war, because people have the right to not be vaporized.
That's right. There's an individual right. I don't think that is the way the world is working yet. So, and there's this constant fight for individual human rights, as you know, these human rights organizations, constantly. And the new fights for human rights now are about women. Absolutely. About women and about gender, not just gender, but sexual orientation. These are the new human rights fights. And they are just still in their infancy, in a way.
What do you think is the role of women, and in the project that you're doing now, adolescent girls, in changing the dialogue and moving the dialogue forward?
We had a long conversation in Istanbul about whether this should just be a girls' project, to just contribute in some way to continue empowerment of girls wherever they may be. And then we decided, no, that this needed to be a project. If we're going to frame a new story of peace in the Middle East, it had to involve adolescent boys as well, because the Israeli boys and girls will be going into the army, every single one of them. They're required to do military service. And so we couldn't leave the boys out. So we just decided that while women's empowerment, many of us believe, will change the world when it happens. Absolutely will change the world when it happens. There are many ways to get there. I've done a lot of work with just women because I really believe in this and women's leadership development and how that empowerment takes place. And I'm particularly interested in the new neuroscience that is delving into the difference between men's and women's brains. And there's a lot of new research on how women excel at tasks that men are traditionally and even today in charge of. And if women ever had a chance to take on those tasks, the world would be much better managed.
And meanwhile, when you talk about, going back to the issues of power, okay, maybe women excel equally or in a superior manner at every task except physical strength, but if you think about military strength as an extension of the male paradigm of physical strength, so, you know, muscle power, weapons, nuclear bombs, they're all kind of in the same category of what we think of as strength. Overcoming that is so daunting because when somebody holds a gun to your head, all dialogue goes out the window.
Right, exactly. So that's one thing we hope would be different, and we're absolutely certain that would be different if women came into leadership, into formal leadership positions.
In high numbers, because as we know from the Thatcher paradigm and a couple of people like that, one individual here and there doesn't make any difference at all.
I was just talking to a friend about critical mass and what that means. We have lots of honorary women in positions of political power. We call them honorary men in positions of political power because they have to come up through these male patriarchal structures, and the feminine side disappears in order for them to get where they are. So there has to be a critical mass to the point where women are routinely in positions of power, not just affiliated in the NGO sector, for example, not just having access, not just being behind the scenes. There's a difference between positional power and affiliated power.
Positional means you hold a position of power. Affiliation means you're the guy's wife or advisor.
Right. And we know women have always played that role.
Right.
And sometimes that can be very powerful also. But we need we need women in positions of power so that it becomes routine. And then the world will change. There's no question about that.
Do the Palestinian teenagers and Israeli teenagers you're working with know this?
I don't. It'll be interesting to find out if they start talking about this. Absolutely, it'll be very interesting to see if they start talking about this. We're not going to guide them in this way. We want to see, honestly, where their imaginations go, and we don't want our adult preconceptions or biases to influence them.
We're talking to international mediator Merle Lefkoff. So we started out talking about this whole idea of victim narratives. And, the reality is that everybody has their victim narrative of one kind or another. I grew up, and no offense to anybody in my wonderful family, but there was a lot of, and it was of the time, there was a lot of sexism, there was a lot of racism, there was a lot of making girls feel like just kind of what you were saying a moment ago, if they wanted to have a powerful position in society, that they would have to be defeminized. And I remember hearing the term, she wears the pants in that family kind of thing, as if that were a negative. It was a way of portraying a woman who had a high position as a man and her husband as a non-man. Those are the kind of things. So you go through trying to, in your 20s, trying to get that stuff out of your system because it's toxic gunk that's in your head, and it's very hard to move forward when you believe that stuff because you've internalized it because that's all you've heard. And so you go through, personally, I went through all of these dialogues and healing and this and that, and I think those things can be successful. You make new paradigms. You get that stuff out of your head. But what I found was when I was going through that, I really loved reading angry feminist books and magazines. And once I was kind of on the other side of the hill, those things seemed really toxic and ugly to me, and I could see how they were the fodder for right-wing hate radio, much as I can't stand that stuff either. But it's not pretty, and in a way it's not right, and I wonder what's the right place for that stuff, because you got to go through the process if you want to unload the kind of emotional toxicity of that stuff. You can't just keep it inside your body for the rest of your life. But I wonder what's the right place for the public and the private expression of those things. Palestine's an example. I mean, it's very important for people to know what's actually going on in Palestine. That shouldn't be private. That should be a publicly aired reality.
Right. No, you said it very, very nicely, Mary Charlotte. I think we've been doing a lot of dialogue work in the Middle East. It's not me. It's really hundreds, perhaps thousands, of facilitated dialogues over the last 20, 30 years between Palestinians and Israelis. And as I said earlier, this is yeast for the bread when the bread finally rises and we can take it out of the oven. We need something else now. We need to figure out how to at least approach some new narratives and some new stories that are not based on past victimization, that aren't based on existing paranoia, that have some idea about what in our wildest imaginations, which is how I think of kids who are 15 and 16 years old, their imaginations are still wild and still capable.
And they haven't been worn down.
They haven't been worn down by life, regardless of where you are, whether you're under occupation or not.
And I would just like to say right now that think about the idea that you've got 14, 15, 16-year-old young people in the occupied territories who have seen their own relatives being killed or hurt or maimed, and their imaginations are still working and they're not worn down. That's huge.
It's huge. And so what we're hoping is that we will hear some remarkable new stories from these young people, and that we can then get these stories to the places where decision makers and policy makers will have to listen to these stories. And that's the blessing of the new social media.
Right.
We can get those stories out. So that's our hope for this. That's our hope for this project, and our hope for a new kind of storytelling about the Middle East that can lead us forward to some really new, breathtaking, wonderful, creative, innovative ideas for how to approach peace in the near future in the Middle East.
You talk about victimization and paranoia. Now, let's say somebody's listening to the Radio Cafe today, and they say, yeah, I mean, if I'm honest with myself, I've got some feelings about that, like they're going to come for me in the night, or I don't have a chance, or whatever your thing is. And you recognize that as paranoia, but it's so deeply ingrained in you because it came from your parents and their parents and so on. What are you supposed to do about it?
Yeah, this is really hard, particularly for Jews, because that paranoia has been based in reality of the oppression of Jews for thousands of years.
Right. So does it qualify as paranoia?
Well, it qualifies for paranoia if you believe that nothing changes. If you don't understand that everything changes all the time and you get stuck in the past, then you cannot move forward. You're always going to think there's no place safe for Jews, and so there must be a Jewish state. You're stuck there, and that's it, and you can't go any further.
And if you really start to analyze it, you realize that if you make a quote-unquote safe place for Jews and you do it in a way that hurts other people, then it becomes not a safe place.
That's exactly right. Right. You're victimizing yourself, going against everything you're trying to do to make it right. And you're just acting completely, as we say in diplomacy, against your own interests. Why are you doing that? And that's the question I ask over and over again about Israeli governmental policy. why are they doing this? Why are they completely acting against their own interests all the time?
And if you think about it, there's deep psychological patterns. I have the suspicion that advances in neuroscience and therapies that come out of neuroscience and the ability, whether it be therapeutic or otherwise, to change neural patterns and to do it in an efficient manner could be the beginning of actual political change.
Oh, that would be wonderful if that could happen. That would be wonderful. You know, there's a psychological dynamic called internalized victimization, so that you play out your victimization in generation after generation on others, because you've internalized that victimization, and that's another way of discharging it, which is to go after other people. And generally, you don't go after your oppressors. You go after people who are able to be oppressed by you.
So people who are the same or lower on the so-called totem pole.
You got it. Right. Black-on-black crime has been looked at in this way as well in the inner cities. Not going after white people, going after each other.
So we just have like a minute or two left. If you want to point people in a direction to continue this conversation, what can ordinary people do?
I would like for people to examine the assumptions underlying particularly the political, the international political stories that they hear. We have access to a lot of information now. And I think it's incumbent upon us as Americans to not just assume that we, when we hear one a fact from one place, that's the reality and that's the truth, but to investigate particularly the places where we are playing a primary role in the oppression of other people. And in the Middle East, that's one of those places. So we have a real responsibility as Americans to examine those policies in a way and get ourselves informed about these policies and ask ourselves, is this really what's going on? How much can I find out about that? I think that's so important to pay attention. Pay attention.
And when you start paying attention to the United States narratives, and you see, for example, how much we spend on military spending and the combination of waste and destruction that goes into that, what do you do with that?
Mary Charlotte, that is another conversation. Because that's a big one. That is a big one. You're absolutely right. That's another conversation, I think.
Well then, ladies and gentlemen, let's leave it here. Merle Lefkoff is an international mediator. She is applying the principles of the science of complexity to diplomacy, peacemaking. She's the founder of Ars Publica, which is a nonprofit group that is based here in Santa Fe. And we're just delighted to have you back on the Radio Cafe, and let's keep the conversation going.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.